So this is a big time of year for the Buddhist community. It's Rohatsu. This is, we celebrate Buddha's enlightenment. And that is something to celebrate. Indeed. I remember I years back I traveled to Bodh Gaya, and I wasn't quite sure why I went. I mean, other than I could go because I was in India, but it was an arduous journey. But because, you know, pilgrimage is something that's a little different. And it was new to me, so I wasn't quite sure about all of the meaning around it. But to experience the sight of Buddha's enlightenment is quite intense. And there were, it wasn't very crowded that day. And there were quite a few Tibetan monks who were doing prostrations on the outside ground, because inside the temple it was very small. It was so small, I couldn't really believe it. With the large Buddha image, but a very narrow passageway to get to the front, to the big Buddha altar. But, you know, there wasn't much room on either side of the passageway, and I hardly had room to do the prostrations once I got to the front. It was very surprising. But a magnificent Buddha. But it was just a whole experience of being at that site, and I recall circumambulating the outside of the temple, generally, you know, at least three times. And there was chanting going on by some Buddhist nuns. So it was in a different language. I think they were from Thailand. And so we had the Tibetans doing their prostrations and this, you know, the chanting by the nuns, and you know, a few pilgrims, you know, going around the outer part of the building, and the Bodhi tree, you know, just shedding its leaves periodically. It was really kind of interesting. It's a big tree, and there's a lot of Tibetan flags strewn across the branches. So it was quite a wonderful experience. So I sat on the outside on the grounds. There was you know, kind of a marble that a stone that was all around the outside of the temple. The temple, by the way, goes straight up like this and then has a point. And it's all around it is this stone outside, but with other stupas, you know, many stupas with other images on them. But it was just a incredible space to be in, and I could find a, you know, a section of the stone to sit on and meditate for a while and take in the situation. It was very I never had any experience quite like that. It was just to be present in that, you know, to know that here was a man that walked the earth, that sat in this space and, you know, woke up. And it was so profound what he found, what he learned. I also went to a couple other sites. I went to Varanasi another year and walked around the place where Shakyamuni delivered his first teaching of the Four Noble Truths. And there were many more pilgrims at this one, probably time of year, that's all, and accessibility. And I remember the people congregated on the grass with maybe their leader, and they did some chanting. But you could walk all the way around, and people put gold. They apparently can get gold squares or something, and they put it on the stone. And so all the way around this huge stupa, I mean, it's not a little thing. It's pretty darn big. It's you have to look up to, see some parts of the stupa that has very kind of ornate. It's almost a European relief on it. And it's like, where does that come from? But you can see that there are layers and layers of stone on this. It's kind of, because it's so old that, as different incidents happen in the area, it was quite, the sites themselves weren't that commercialized. They're just kind of tucked away in different places. It was very interesting. Some lawn around them, but it isn't like a real commercialized site. But the one that kind of triggered this thought to tell you this story, which I hadn't planned, was I had also been to Kushinagar and to the place where Buddha passed into Nirvana, and saw the trees, supposedly, where he lay. There is a stupa there that's incredibly simple. They have a couple things going on there. They have a temple and then a stupa. Well, I went into the temple, and there is a reclining Buddha. And this Buddha is pretty big. He goes from that wall all the way probably to that post over there. It's a big Buddha, and that's all that's in that temple. That's it. It's very low to the ground, so it's like right about here. And then there's a cloth that's kind of draped over the Buddha. It just struck me, the simplicity of the and beauty of the space that, housed this image. But what was so profound for me was when I walked around the stupa and really settled into the magnitude of what Shakyamuni experienced for all of us, for all being. I mean, that is amazing. So every circumambulation of the stupa just, intensified. It's like all these beings just, just kept coming forth. Was the past, present, and future all right there. It was just an amazing experience. And it was dusk, so very few people were there. So it's like your private experience, with all beings, if that's possible. It was quite wonderful. So that's a good reason to celebrate as we Shakyamuni's enlightenment, because it's there for all of us, every one of us, and that's the gift. So Buddha, the awakened one. So Dogen is in our lineage as the Soto founder, Soto school founder, and he says, we are Buddha. We are Buddha nature. It's a natural state of existence. For Dogen, he struggles with the idea of, well, if we're Buddha, then, why are we... What's why must we practice, and how does that, you know, how does the interplay of practice and realization really work? And so he went to China to learn about this, and that's where he developed or saw the benefits of Shikantaza and incorporated that into the practice. He himself was from the Tendai school and felt that something was lacking, and he found it with his teacher in China, and then brought it back to Japan. So what was this, that, you know, journey that Shakyamuni was on? And Dogen went on his journey, and really we're all on a journey. But Shakyamuni was, for us, the one we acknowledge, who was the person who woke up. Shakyamuni, you know, lived a lot of his life. I mean, when you think of, you know, maybe, I don't know how long people lived at that time, but still, he became an adult. When he was an adult is really when he first experienced illness and saw old age and death. And, you know, for us, you know, these things are prevalent. I mean, for us in our society, we maybe don't come up close to death as maybe it is and was in India, but certainly Shakyamuni was shielded from that. So his experience was that he wanted to know about this suffering, wanted to know how does this suffering happen? Does everyone suffer? And is there an end to suffering? So this was one of his awakenings, and it's one of the first teachings he gave in Varanasi, which, by the way, is a long way from Bodh Gaya. It's a very long way. I myself took a train, but I can't imagine walking. So the Four Noble Truths, the truth of suffering. So we all have our personal journey. And when you think about why did you come to practice, there might have been something that related to, you know, impermanence or the suffering of change or just the unsatisfactoriness of life, that something didn't satisfy you. Or you could have had this yearning that you maybe had a long time in your life and didn't know quite how to resolve that. But as Shakyamuni, who had to leave the castle, to leave the cocoon of his experience, we too have to leave our way of being in some form. Maybe it's a destructive relationship. Maybe it's a habit, a mind habit that we have that we need to give up. Maybe it's some bad behavior. And along with that, when we give it up, we may experience a little bit of depression about it. Some sadness that we have to let go of something that we were very attached to. So imagine Shakyamuni giving all of this up as he left the castle and with his attendant went some distance from the castle, and when he came to the river's edge, he stopped and dismounted from the horse and returned the remaining items to his attendant to bring back to the castle. And then he shaved his head, he cut his hair. These are very symbolic of letting go of attachment that we actually, as practitioners, especially people who've gone through priest ordination, know that there is the symbolic cutting off of attachment. Some people actually shave their head, but you do have the as part of the ceremony, the cutting of the hair. It's cutting off attachment. Similarly, we have the full moon ceremony, full and new moon ceremony. I don't know if you practice that here, but there is also the taking of the precepts, which Shakyamuni did when he made that vow to enter the stream of becoming at the river's edge. After he went, left his attendant and continued to go into the forest, Shakyamuni found some other companions and other ascetics who were practicing. Mm-hmm. They have what's called forest practices that they do. They maybe practice something like going to the town, you know, for their meal in a begging bowl, using a begging bowl. Possibly they never slept in the same place. They may be sitting in meditation for a long period of time, or there may be some other austere practices. We do know that at one point Shakyamuni, you know, reduced his food intake to a grain of rice. You know, became totally emaciated. A forest practice. We have practices too that we do. Besides our sitting practice, we do prostrations. We offer incense and flowers. We practice orioki. We have soji, which is temple cleaning practice. So we also have practices. So each of these practices are have some significance in our own practice in terms of providing another opportunity to wake up. You may also find some of your practices take you into reading texts. Maybe you read different contemporary teachers and masters, like we know Koban and Katagiri and Suzuki Roshi all have some writings that are accessible to us. Plus there's Shobogenzo, Dogen's writings. And then there's the early sutras, like the middle-length discourses of the Buddha. So for Shakyamuni, you know, he tried those forest practices. And he actually, no doubt, was familiar with the religions of the day. And the ascetics who he was practicing with were basically rejecting conventional religion. They, you know, it wasn't working for them, so otherwise why were they there? So they were taking it to a new level because they were seekers of the truth. After Buddha was enlightened, he himself said that we must experience the truth ourselves. No one can give you that. It isn't in the scriptures. You have to experience it. Those are like good pointers of how to get there, but ultimately it's really your experience. You're the one that has to experience truth for yourself. And so That's like the acid test for, you know, determining whether or not something's working for you. You know, do you find you're able to realize truth about the nature of reality, about your true self? So here's Shakyamuni on his journey. He has these companions who, a very close-knit group, they supported one another. And, you know, as he reached a stage of, you know, close to death with total emaciation, you know, this rigorous restraint and denial of even taking care of his physical body in any way, he decided that when he was approached by a woman to have some milk, he did take it and he refreshed himself, because he saw the shortcomings of the practices. When faced with death, right, you know, well, try something else, right? If that's not working, and so, you know, like any person, well, let's try this. And, you know, his friends just really rejected him at that point. They turned away from him and they said, this man doesn't know what he's doing. We'll leave him now. But as Shakyamuni gained strength from eating food and drinking the fluids that he needed, he was able to turn the currents around. There's a teaching from Lama Tsongkhapa, the great Tibetan master. His teaching is of the three principles of the path. The first principle is regarding renunciation. And the second is the altruistic wish for enlightenment. And the third is the perfect understanding of emptiness. And in that teaching, he actually uses this same phrase about turning the currents around. He uses it differently. He describes the state the state of human beings as constantly swept along by four fierce river currents: birth, aging, sickness, and death, carried forward by karmic seed, difficult to undo. So the causal torrents that result in a cyclic existence are the torrent of ignorance. This is the obstructions that can be only eliminated by the path of meditation and seeing. Then there's a torrent of views, which is false views about the transitory nature of phenomena, thinking it's real, or even ourselves, of I, me, and mine. Extreme views, wrong views, or maybe misguided forms of discipline and conduct. And then there's the torrent of desire, which includes disturbing attitudes and emotions associated with the desire realm. And we wouldn't be complete without including the form and the formless realm, which is the torrent of world existence. So these are the torrents, that the currents that Shakyamuni was able to turn around. He broke through the hindrances, any obstructions. He was visited by the demons, by Mara, and questioned about all of these, his attachment to the things in the realm of desire. But there Shakyamuni stayed on that lotus throne. Just like each of you. So, what are the wisdoms that come with awakening? These are the same wisdoms available to you. The first is universal mirror wisdom. This is direct knowing, no labeling, no naming, seeing things as they are, without conceptual glasses. Then there's the wisdom of equality. This is equanimity towards everything that arises, without turning away or attaching or grasping to it. It applies in all of the sense fields, the six senses, and seeing that everything is your enlightened nature. And then there's the wisdom of observing cognition. So in this wisdom, you see clearly and understand the principles of differentiation. You see the differentiation in the backdrop of oneness, and you don't see the separateness. And you start seeing the whole. Some of this comes as you study the teachings. They will become clear to you as to their meaning. And you embody the teachings instead of something out there. They are then inside of you. And then there's the performing wisdom or practical wisdom. And this is action in harmony with insight. So this is how one carries forward in their life, because of the knowledge you have through your experience. It is bliss. It is purity, and it is your true self. Well, there's a lot that more could be said, but I think the time is saying enough. So with that, I thank you. We have some time, I suppose, a minute or two.
I have a question. Is any of those forest practices still, is there a remnant of that still happening, or do you know anything?
In India?
Well,
yes.
I know in India with the sadhus there is. But
yeah. Yes. Yeah. They are,
but
there.
Maybe the sadhus are a little different from that path, that they're more into the Indian.
Yes, right, but I wouldn't, my own experiences, I don't know about any like Buddhist practitioners who do practice that way, in that sense, the same way. That's not to say that they're not there, yes.
I was wondering if you could say something about Buddha's experience when he sat under the tree and he saw the, looked at the morning star.
Mm-hmm.
And had enlightenment, and I know from what I've heard, I think Coben used to talk about that some in this. So I don't know if anyone else knows anything, but that's always kind of fascinating me, and it seems like everyone has something slightly different to say about it.
So what did he say? To me, his experience is that he was able to penetrate all realms and see into the interconnectedness of everything, and that everything goes on. There's no beginning and no end. That it's just this. And that everything, everyone is sacred because it's all just this. And it's for all of us. I think for Shakyamuni, the experience is that he experienced it and then just didn't know how to talk about it. How do you talk about something everybody is already, you know? How do you convince them? So he didn't teach for like 3 months or so. He didn't walk out the door and start talking about it. As many people, even in our own lineage, and when they awaken, it takes time to integrate the experience. So that's why you see a gap in the time of his enlightenment and actually when he started to teach. Maybe Michael has some. I don't know if you have any thoughts about. I'm not sure I know what Coben is.
I don't remember. Do you know, Peter? Remember anything Coben said about that?
Mm-hmm. That's not specifically enough to reiterate. No?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Brian, you had a question?
I was just going to make 2 comments. One to Michael, that there is, I have a friend who did forest practice in Thailand where a lot of times there'd be ants crawling all over him.
Mm-hmm.
That's not the set of practice that I'm really engaged in, but it's pretty extreme. And the other was about the morning star. For me, there are certain practices, just our practice here, and you do a hin outside. And you can kind of very quickly lose a sense of the separation between yourself and others, mm-hmm. just the trees, everything. You suddenly you're just, instead of seeing, you're sort of in the scene. So I feel like to extend that sense of oneness to a star is pretty extreme. That's another level I wouldn't pretend to. So that's what I've always thought of, is that when he incorporated the morning star in his sense of the self, then he was fully enlightened.
Thank you. I was thinking about stars and kind of like a hobby for me. But for this month's calendar that Suzuki Roshi that was put together of some of his calligraphy and sayings. This is one that maybe would fit in. It says, wherever you are one with the clouds and one with the sun and the stars that you see. You are still one with everything. That is more than I can say and more true than you can hear.
Can you show that?
Oh, yes, it's a partial. Your Enzo. Yes, Doug.
The tradition has seven predecessors to Buddha. And probably more. And how do you see that? How do you see the history of that? How do you see the significance of that?
Well, I think it's that realization is there for everyone. And, you know, Shakyamuni is one who were able to somehow relate directly to because of the teachings that have come down to us, but that's not to diminish any of the awakenings of the prior Buddhas or Buddhas who are awakening now in this. We just don't know, you know. But we awaken with all beings when we awaken. So it's happening right now. So they're not in the past. When you awaken with all beings, and the awakening is right now. It's not in the past. Not in the conventional way that we think of past, present, future. There's in timelessness, there is no past, present, and future. And that's why you awaken with all beings when you awaken. So they're here. Just like probably in a conventional sense, there'll be others after. And maybe all of us.